Hey everyone, welcome back to the forum. My name is Daniela, and as always, I'm joined by my favorites, Aubrey and Cleo.
Hey guys, thanks for joining us again. I'm Aubrey.
Hello, hello. I'm Cleo, and I'm happy for the three of us to be back together again for our second new episode of 2018.
It's really hard to believe this is the podcast's third year already, isn't it? It kind of makes you feel old.
Tell me about it. I recently hit the quarter life milestone.
And that's assuming you make it to 100.
Aubrey!
What? I'm just saying.
Yeah, well, with everything standing in my way of actually reaching 100 in this world, it is a pretty good point.
Yeah, I guess that's true. Heck, even listening to our climate change, sea level rise, or even food safety episodes, it's easy to start worrying a lot.
Well, I wouldn't be so sure about food safety. Actually, sometimes we worry too much about food safety. Or at least get too much information about it from way too many sources.
What exactly do you mean?
Well, actually, that's the whole topic of today's episode, so let's go ahead and get this show started. Today, we'll be talking about public perceptions of food safety risks, including challenges, how they affect policymaking, and what solutions could be adopted. This podcast is based on a policy position paper entitled Risk Perception: A Challenge to the Development of Risk-Based Food Safety Policy, which was debated at the Institute on Science for Global Policy's Conference on Food Safety, Security, and Defense, Safeguarding the American Food Supply.
This paper was written by Dr. Robert Buchanan and debated by participating scientists along with policymakers and other stakeholders. Dr. Buchanan is director and professor at the Center for Food Safety and Security Systems at the College of Agriculture and Natural Resources at the University of Maryland.
You can breathe now. And as all of our listeners know, we value your input, so please make sure to send us your comments or questions using our Twitter handle at ISGP Forum, or you can also search the hashtag ISGP Forum.
And you can also find us on Facebook by searching ISGP's The Forum. And these call-outs to social media seem particularly appropriate since we'll be talking about social media a bit today.
And actually, you know what I just found out?
I can't wait to hear this one.
Go on, D.
Well, okay, this is only relevant if you have an iPhone. But you know the little podcast app that comes with your phone?
Yeah.
So if you search ISGP's The Forum on it, you can subscribe to our show directly and get an alert on your phone every single time we release a new episode. How cool is that?
Your lack of knowledge about the iPhone world is really cute.
Yeah, D. Sorry to say we all knew this already. It's because we're on iTunes as well, which you better have already known.
Of course I knew that. I just didn't know the two were connected. Oops.
Anyway, so let's actually get this show started.
Right, okay. So let's begin with an overview of the issue here. When considering risk in food safety and security, the public frequently adopts different views depending on whether the risk is posed to the individual or to the nation.
Right. So Dr. Buchanan argues that it's therefore necessary to adopt food safety strategies that balance the needs of a nation with the desires of the individual.
Well, that definitely seems easier said than done.
Right. So do we have any idea of what desires individuals are likely to have?
Well, recent trends in public opinion suggest that individuals want to be provided with the safest and least processed products, two qualifiers that may not be actually achievable simultaneously because food technologies that enhance safety often require processing.
So ironically, it was recognized that while radical food processing treatments exist that promote food safety, such as bacteriophages and radiation, their current use is rarely publicized broadly because of this individual desire for the least processed foods and the corresponding negative stigma surrounding processed foods.
Nice.
Yeah. And on top of that, incorporating the needs of the consumer with those of a nation actually requires that consumers be a part of the policymaking and writing the associated laws. And as we've mentioned repeatedly on past episodes, attempts to increase public participation in policymaking has its own set of difficulties.
Even the channels used to consult the public are complicated. Now, it's important to recognize that the establishment of laws or regulations must follow the guidelines set out in the Administrative Procedures Act of 1946.
In accordance to these rules, novel regulations must be subjected to public comment prior to enactment, and the public comment period may manifest during public meetings or, more recently, online.
However, the process is complicated because the Federal Register for Public Commentary is, let's be honest, neither user-friendly nor easily accessible.
And not surprisingly, these impracticalities limit the number and variety of opinions gathered from the general public. In fact, Dr. Buchanan argues that the current method of involving the public in establishing policies and laws, including food safety laws, is ineffective and hinders transparency between policymakers and their constituents.
The debaters went on to underline that the public tends to distrust the government-regulated system of establishing and maintaining food safety, in part because of this ineffective method of obtaining public comments on food regulations.
And adding to this relationship of distrust is the food industry's profit-oriented motives. Many people simply do not believe that priorities for food safety and profit can coexist. They think that one will always have to trump the other.
Right. Lack of public trust in food safety was also attributed in part to non-transparency between supply chain actors and the public.
But there was some disagreement among debaters regarding the amount of information made available to consumers from food producers. While many producers regularly open their facilities to the public, some production practices remain hidden, and this tends to depend largely on individual producers.
And consumer distrust is exacerbated when risk information is disseminated by groups or individuals that are not trustworthy or knowledgeable in food safety risk assessments, such as online blogs or social media accounts. And this is where we'll spend a lot of time today, because trust, or lack thereof, is central to the perception of food safety risk. And there is no better place to learn reasons to not trust things than social media.
But this creates a conflict between reliability and accessibility. While debaters agreed that sources such as social media should not be the final authority influencing the public's perceptions, these non-credible sources are often the most accessible suppliers of information.
Right. Ultimately, the quality and source of information are correlated, regardless of the theme. And the scientists performing studies upon which food safety regulations are developed are typically untrained in communication tactics targeting the public, you know, as we've discussed on this show in the past. Consequently, both traditional and non-traditional media sources contribute to sensationalized risk information for consumers.
Specifically, social media provides a platform for both accurate and inaccurate information to be communicated to the public. And then the issue is that it becomes the reader's responsibility to identify the valuable material.
So, while we're all fans of the First Amendment right to free speech, of course, the dissemination of incorrect food-related information by untrustworthy sources is a very serious concern. Consumer advocates need to play a vital role in raising awareness of pseudoscience, and scientists must view this as an opportunity to be a point of engagement.
Debaters agreed that consumers need access to a reliable source of information that can be used to corroborate media-disseminated reports or alleviate associated concerns.
So, how would we do this?
Well, Dr. Buchanan explained that since consumers tend to be skeptical of supply chain practices and regulations, scientific advancements in food safety can seek to enhance trust in the food system. This could be achieved by identifying values shared by all stakeholders in the supply chain, making parties with fundamentally different interests or goals, such as producers versus consumers, more relatable to one another.
Okay, I think I get what you're saying. So, for instance, two common values for producers and consumers regarding food are safety and environmental protection. These two concerns could underlie science-based decisions impacting the food system. Let me give you an example I think you'll like. Scientific advancements in food safety, such as developing disease-resistant crops, can simultaneously benefit the environment by, for example, increasing yield without increasing resource input.
Yeah, that is a great example. And another opportunity for enhancing trust in the food supply chain involves encouraging consumers to take more active roles in the production of their food by working in large-scale or personal food production. And this is actually giving me flashbacks to our very first episode of the forum, which had a lot to do with finding ways to encourage, I guess, the next generation to make it out to the farm. So, Cleo, you have got firsthand experience in this with your time at the farm. How trusting of the food supply chain are you?
Well, you know me and my love for food. I'm not sure I could be any more trusting. But, I mean, all jokes aside, you definitely have a point, Aubrey. As consumers take more active roles, individuals like me gain firsthand knowledge that improves their understanding of the complex challenges that dictate how food is produced and processed.
However, there was some disagreement between the debaters regarding the practicality and effectiveness of the suggestion, since working in food production was not really a popular occupation at the time of this conference.
Are you implying that it is now?
Well, I don't know, but I do think interest in farm work is increasing among the younger generation.
Probably because of our podcast episode, I'm just saying.
Definitely, certainly. The past few years, maybe 2, 3 years since we started, have witnessed all types of new opportunities to engage in farm work, both domestically through university collaborations or even through international exchange platforms such as the World Organization of Organic Farms, or some like to call it WOOF. But that, of course, is just anecdotal.
Well, Cleo, was your farm experience through one of those programs?
It wasn't, but I do know several people that have participated in those types of programs.
Well, actually, both my sister and I have gone woofing, as woofers like to call it. I spent about a month living and working on a farm in the south of France, while my sister actually spent about 6 months living and working on different farms throughout Florida.
While these are definitely cool opportunities, they make up only a small step towards increasing consumer awareness because scientists still face a massive challenge in finding appropriate methods to transmit relevant food safety and risk information to consumers, especially those consumers who are unable to take time off and partake in such hands-on programs.
Right, and this is particularly true because scientists are competing against pseudoscientists and even celebrities who disseminate incorrect information and hinder trust in scientific authority.
As we've seen over the past 2 years, it's difficult to address the spread of misinformation. Overtly discrediting the views suggested by unreliable sources may draw unnecessary attention to those sources and their opinions, resulting in inadvertent validation and public attention.
And on top of that, individuals may seek information that supports previously held beliefs, which non-credible sources generally can provide.
Exactly. And in light of these challenges, many opportunities exist to improve transparency between scientific authorities and the public by designating appropriate individuals to communicate scientific information in an accessible manner.
Bill Nye, the science guy. Bill. Come on, you guys don't know
Oh.
the
We do know that song, and we also know your love for Bill, Daniela. And his show can be found on Netflix, and admittedly is a decent example of what we're talking about.
True. But remember, guys, debaters couldn't actually come to an agreement about whether scientists should be responsible for interacting with the public, since scientists are often unable to translate technical information into universally understandable language.
So, it was proposed that the most successful liaison between science and the recipients of scientific information would be an individual or group that has the capacity to properly understand the scientific knowledge, but can, importantly, emphasize with consumers' needs and give context to the complexities of the global food systems producers and regulators.
And on the same note, stakeholders within the food industry are also responsible for disseminating information, occasionally contributing to the public's acceptance of incomplete or inaccurate food safety material.
This can get tricky because companies compete with each other for shelf space and consumers' dollars in the marketplace, resulting in brand information being pitched in a way that can be pretty misleading for the consumer.
Right. Such marketing strategies also influence what consumers think they want or need. For example, a societal desire for GMO-free food is in part intensified by companies using GMO-free labels as part of their marketing strategies. This leads consumers to believe that choosing GMO-free is the healthier choice, when in fact, that product may not even have a genetically modified version on the market.
Oh, you mean the water bottles that say GMO and gluten-free? Those are my favorite. But now I feel that I do need to clarify. No water is genetically modified, nor does any water contain gluten, at least right now. Unless it's dirty water that's been used to clean a waffle maker or something and then repackaged and sold to us in a very strange way.
That would be really strange for sure.
It would be. Yeah.
Anyway, as we've discussed in several of our past episodes, this labeling phenomenon leads to people believing that GMOs are harmful and just overall poor options for food. But GMO labeling is a whole topic on its own, and we've talked about it before, so we won't go off on that tangent today.
Okay, so anyhow, there was disagreement among the debaters regarding whether larger or smaller businesses are more likely to use marketing strategies that detrimentally impact public understanding of accurate food-related information.
However, they did agree that if communication practices change, private industry stakeholders need to be able to promote and protect their brands. There exists a need to educate the electorate, which is a challenging task, seeing as the interpretation of statistics and their practical significance is not first nature for all.
Finding better ways to educate the public requires developing methods by which information can be presented to maximize interest and minimize sensationalizing the material.
So, as you mentioned, Dee, scientific material delivered by popular science television shows, such as Bill Nye's, or documentaries, is often embraced by the public, and similar formats might provide opportunities to present scientifically credible food safety information to consumers. Not to harp on the GMO thing, but wasn't a documentary recently released on those?
Food Evolution, yeah. It sought to explain what GMOs are, why such controversy surrounds them, and it even took a look at some case studies where their production has been either embraced or, quite the opposite, blocked. I saw it myself. My alma mater had a showing, and I'm no movie critic, but it seemed to give a well-rounded perspective while not providing any direct opinions of its own. So hopefully what we do on this show, but in movie form.
And that's exactly the sort of documentary that tends to be embraced by the public, one that provides full disclosure info and lets the viewer decide his or her own opinion.
In addition to popular television, debaters also suggested that professional communicators within a respected scientific society, such as the National Academy of Sciences, for instance, could actually fulfill the communication role. In this case, their responsibilities would necessarily include the dispersal of accurate information and confirmation that food safety data submitted for publication are well supported.
Right. They urged that U.S. government agencies involved in monitoring and regulating food safety, such as the Food and Drug Administration and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, need expanded authority to allow for a more active role in discrediting inaccurate information from media sources.
And it was emphasized that this needs to be a two-way street. In addition to government agencies doing their monitoring, the public can also partake in monitoring activities. They suggested establishing a publicly accessible and officially accredited internet forum through which consumers and other food stakeholders could exchange information.
Such an outlet could provide an effective venue, not only for the dissemination of appropriate food safety knowledge, but also for the solicitation of public commentary on proposed food-based regulations, back to what we talked about at the beginning of the show. Improved public education may prompt consumers to ask the right questions about food risk and safety.
However, some debate participants hesitated to give full authority for food safety information to a single department or organization, as a single organization is unlikely to earn enough public trust to be seen as the final authority.
And just to throw one of ISGP's overarching themes in here, it was also agreed that schools need to incorporate curricula to teach students about food safety and risk. Case study-based learning could demonstrate what happens before, during, and after events of compromised food safety.
Oh, of course. I mean, would this even be an episode of the forum if we didn't touch on education?
I don't think so. Certainly not. The underlying theme and solution to so many of the current issues discussed here on the forum is always education. Not sure if that's because we're a bunch of nerds or...
Well, I mean, probably that too. But it's definitely key. Dr. Buchanan suggested that it would be beneficial to bolster high school level education regarding civics, government, and the process of policymaking in an effort to improve the public's understanding of how food-related policies are created.
So, we've understood the importance of informing the public appropriately in order to engage them in the conversation and decision-making process. But now we need to talk about the next step. What did the debaters discuss regarding actual policymaking?
Well, it was agreed that food safety policies need to be both risk and science-based, take both social and economic costs into consideration, and equally prioritize individual and group-based risks.
Individual and group-based risks. What quite do you mean by that?
Well, we touched on it at the top of the show, but individuals need to have the opportunity to make decisions that may include a risk to themselves. However, their decisions cannot endanger the lives of others. Just as physically harming another person results in legal action, imperiling others on the basis of personal food preferences, such as serving unpasteurized milk, also needs to be addressed by policy.
Right. Policy must set safety standards, which in fact may be different between large and small-scale productions.
Good point. When developing policies for food production, it's particularly important to balance the needs of small and large-scale producers. However, conflicting opinions were expressed by the debaters regarding whether regulations should be enacted in a size-neutral or size-dependent manner.
Yeah, probably because creating uniform regulations would be less complicated, you know, when all producers are affected equally regardless of facility size. But on the other hand, smaller farms lack the resources, including novel technologies, possessed by larger operations and therefore might be unable to enact the same protocols.
Maybe there could be just two regulatory frameworks addressing smaller and larger scale productions at one cutoff line.
Right, but surely this could have unexpected effects when considering facilities that fall close to that cutoff line. Black and white is tough to pull off here. You usually need the gray, for lack of better terms.
Yeah, I could see that. And if we had the black and white method, then we have the question of who decides where the cutoff is, and who is the monitoring body. Would there be one body overseeing both small and large facilities, or would there be two separate entities? How would standards be enforced?
All right, you've got my head spinning.
Point for Daniela.
Hey!
Well, the debaters couldn't come to an agreement because of exact issues like the ones you just brought up, Dee. So maybe this is a good time to recap and let our listeners tell us what they think.
All right, good idea. So, to recap, consumers can be educated about their food choices by a variety of sources, and although it's impossible to ensure that they receive accurate information, it is important to increase the likelihood that they will.
There is a fundamental difference between obtaining information from a company attempting to promote its product and receiving information from individuals disseminating inaccurate information for other purposes. Because of technology and social media, freelance writers, whether well-intentioned or not, are extremely accessible sources of information for consumers, and they're very skilled at communicating in a way that is understandable to the general public. In this case, quote-unquote freelance writers can even be interpreted to mean celebrities or your favorite YouTube celebrity or blogger.
How detrimental are these sources when it comes to giving the public wrong information? It's hard to say, but one thing's certain. Their voices reach people way more frequently and way more easily than scientists or other trusted information sources.
And while oftentimes these people can be discredited in the public eye, sometimes these writers reach many consumers and gain a large following before the information is discredited, after which time they're not held accountable.
All of this affects consumer choice, which should also be affected by food safety standards. So the question finally became whether large and small food production facilities should be held to the same regulatory standards.
So join the debate and lend us your thoughts. Which information channel is the most appropriate to reach consumers and raise food safety awareness?
Do you think small and large scale food production should be required to follow the same regulatory framework, or should two separate frameworks be developed?
And most importantly, any fellow woofers out there, have you had firsthand experience on farms? Has it helped you understand the complexities of the food production supply chain? Send us your thoughts on Twitter at ISGPForum or by using the hashtag ISGPForum.
You can also, of course, leave us your comments on our Facebook page by searching ISGP's The Forum.
And as Dee so kindly reminded us at the beginning of this episode, subscribe on your smartphone's podcast app so you're notified when we release new episodes on all kinds of topics.
As always, thanks everyone for socializing with science today. We'll catch you next time, right here on the forum.
The Institute on Science for Global Policy, or ISGP, is a nonprofit organization that convenes international meetings bringing together scientists, policymakers, industry leaders, students, and other stakeholders to discuss pertinent scientific issues facing society. The ISGP has no opinions and does not lobby. Therefore, the preceding podcast reflects the views expressed by the presenters and debaters at our conference. For more information, please visit our website at www.scienceforglobalpolicy.org. Thank you.